Good morning. Looks like we've grown a little bit since yesterday. Nice to see new faces this morning. In our session, there's coming and going really all week long. And of course on Sunday, the gate is open and Sunday comes. So that's very nice, and we all get to see each other and get a taste of Sesshin. It's a very quiet and peaceful Sesshin so far. One never knows. It's new every breath. And there's nothing predicted about anything. But everyone is making a big effort. And the quiet is making an enormous difference. I think we can all be grateful for the kind of polite quietness that is prevailing. It isn't rigid. It isn't strict. There isn't any granny who's going to come and bop you if you say something. But I think people understand what a difference it makes to be quiet. I dressed up this morning because yesterday was so hot that I came in my undershirt to give the talk. And I thought, well, it's much cooler today, so maybe I should be more proper to the Sunday group especially. This is a Sunday that is being recognized all over the country. The Sikh community made a request to clergy in the United States. I think every flavor of clergy got a request to have a moment of silence, a minute of silence, in honor of the people who were killed, and then to offer what they called a request of the divine. They say that they end their Sunday service with this little prayer. May everyone in the world be blessed, and may good come to all. Does that sound familiar? We're all doing that. We're all finding words to say something like that. So let's have a moment of silence, not only for the Sikhs and their effort to find haven here, but for all beings who suffer, all beings who need help. May everyone in the world be blessed, and may good come to all. Even if we close the door and lock the gate, the world comes right in. The world is with us. We're not doing this to escape our own pain or the world's pain. And our work is to find the courage and the intelligence, the intuitive intelligence, to be able to face the way things are. We spend so much time distracting ourselves, not just turning over in bed, as I said the other day. Every time we feel a little pain in our sleep, we turn and get more comfortable. In our practice, we actually don't turn. We step back. Step back so that our perspective is wider and more clear. And less personally attached. It isn't about disconnecting ourselves. It's really the opposite. The usual connection we feel is all about me. What am I getting out of this? How can I get out of this? How can I get rid of this? I want more. But stepping back, we can see more widely and begin to feel what our need really is. We have needs, and they're deep. And not just for food and shelter and clothing and friendship and connection. But there's some life question that we carry. What is this? Who am I? Where do I am I supposed to be? This is called way-seeking mind. And if we look back into our own lives, we see that all along, something has been bringing us to this point right here, right now. It's remarkable when you really stop to think about it. Usually we skim across the surface so easily explain everything to ourselves that we don't recognize how truly strange it is. That somehow, through all the years of our life, something has brought us here, right now. We talk about way, the way seeking, and yet we are the way. As I said yesterday, the harder we look out there, the farther away it seems. And so this practice, difficult as it is, of sitting down in the way, you could say, at the crossroads, you could say, and just be the way and the crossroads, to be the vertical and the horizontal, and to let what comes come. We often come to Sesshin, almost always, with an intention. And often that intention is to duplicate something that happened before, or try to escape from something that happened before. And it's very important to notice that you can never duplicate whatever happened before, ever. That's true of everything, really. But especially in Zazen, you can't expect to have a glorious, blissful experience if you had that one time, or a very disappointing one. The only way to come to the cushion is simply to offer oneself to Zazen. To simply allow what comes to come. And sometimes it feels like Zazen isn't coming. We have some idea about how it should be. And then there becomes a kind of struggle between the I want and the way it really is. So in a way, we're just practicing over and over accepting the way things really are. And developing a kind of scientific curiosity to be a question mark rather than a ready answer to everything. To allow ourselves not to know. To be open to asking, what is this? And what's this? If we're willing to ask, to face it and ask, already the answer is in the question. Not always obviously. It's a deep study. We call it the study of the self. And really, everything that we say about it is so feeble compared to the actuality of our own living life. And yet, we have to say something to point toward the living life of it. Someone asked a teacher, what is Zazen, and the teacher said, it's alive. It's not some fancy practice. It's a powerful expression of the life of the universe itself. Something is pouring through us and enlivening and empowering. Even such as we. And so, when we have a request like this, the request that just came to us, we actually can answer that request. But that's what this is for, to be able to answer a request like this. So after 2 days or a day and a half of sitting, it seems a little confounding. It's hard to know what we're doing here. It's best not to try to explain it to oneself. Best not to try to analyze it or expect anything. But as a friend of mine always says, just enjoy your breathing. Just enjoy every breath. And be glad you're getting another breath. And let the breath be what it wants to be. Just as you let Zazen be what it wants to be, the breath can be what it wants to be. You don't have to impose anything on it. Buddha said, just if it's a short breath, let it be a short breath. And if it's a long one, let it be a long one. You'll be surprised how different your breathing can be all through a short time. Just as your thoughts keep shifting and changing all through a short time. And you begin to see how saying I about my thoughts or I about my breath is a little off. Who's breathing? What's breathing? The whole thing is breathing. Well, I have a lot of notes here, but I don't understand them at this point. So. I guess the other thing I wanted to say is how much our experience plays into our own life experience, plays into our practice in Sesshin. And since our life experience is lay practice, this gathering for 1 week and taking on monk's practice, nun's practice, is quite unusual still. It's quite unusual in Japan at this point, and certainly in America, although it's beginning to develop in many, many different places. And it seems for all of us who live at so-called home, understanding how practice and home, Sesshin and family, the life of sustaining oneself and the life of nourishing oneself in this way, all require a really deep study. We have two ordination practices. One is called staying home and practicing the way. And that's called also Jukai. And then the other one is leaving home and practicing the way. So this can be understood in a very strict way as and literal way, as you receive a rakusu and you stay home and set up an altar. You already have an altar and you already have a practice and you continue to practice. Koban always said, go home and have babies, to all his young students. Remember? And of course that's important, because without a real foundation of people who truly understand this practice and live it every day and support it, any kind of monastic practice, even if it's a retreat center with that rents out the space and has a sesshin every now and then, that the lay community is an enormous part of the support of a place like this. And people are staying home mostly and practicing. But some people ordain the home-leaving way. And that's always a kind of puzzle. Does that mean that I leave my husband? Well, no. It doesn't. It means that there's a different relationship with everything. And that instead of home being one place, that home is everywhere we go. And so practicing at home means practicing in the car, or at the nursery school, or on the beach, wherever we go. Of course, that's the truth of it anyway, but there are ways of honoring that and recognizing that and vowing to be that, which is a powerful and very transformational vow. And yet at the same time, it's all ordinary. And especially in our practice, it's ordinary. We don't rise. As Koban said, it's always a stepping down. So having come here to sit for a week, we have stepped down from our home life, you could say, to become monks and nuns, and to support the life of this center, and to step back and create some perspective on what we call myself, my life, my world, so that in the end, what we're able to give comes from a very deep place, a committed place, a place of real intention. So, are there questions? Comments? Donalyn?
Who did Koban say it was older students too old for kids? Who do you think he'd say?
Oh, I see what you mean. Just keep practicing till your death day. That's what he would say. Well, yeah. And they're the grandchildren, so it goes on and on. There's no end to it, really. Request.
The request that you answer to the request.
Ah. I said question.
Oh, question.
Yes. Oh. Yes. Yes.
And they're asking the very first sentences. You mentioned something about silence and how the silence is holding everything, but the way you said that was so wonderful and I forgot. Can you say, I don't know whether you can say this again.
I don't think I can. It's in here. It's in you.
Yeah, and I can't find it, but it is so amazing.
It's right down here. Anything else?
Yesterday, if it's okay to refer to yesterday, an intelligence center, so when you were talking about our posture and our hands and that we're holding it. I was wondering if you could say more about where that is and what that is.
Well, I haven't studied it very well. I've just been marveling over the little bit that I know, which is that there are nodules of nerves, intelligence nerves, in our hearts, are in our heart system and in our belly, and that they are all they're all connected with the brain. So obviously it's serving the whole system. And since what we've known from our practice, what we are taught as this is the center of our wisdom, in our belly, and then the heart. So, and that this intelligence up here that we depend on and favor so much is simply kind of the worker bee that is, or the office boy, sort of running the errands for the wisdom that is informing us. Now, I don't know if anatomically how exact that is, but there's something like that going on in us, and we're just beginning to discover it. And I think it's marvelous. Yeah.
I have one question today, which I think is related. You also mentioned yesterday, you're talking about the mind as one source of knowing or not fully knowing, and intuition is one source of knowing, but also partial, and then talked about our wisdom as the real place of knowing. And I guess I was confused about the difference between our wisdom and our intuition, and maybe what you meant by those two. I don't know if they're still related to the body, but...
Well, in one sense, we have a relationship with things. How we know everything is a thingification of our world. We name it and separate each thing from each other thing and have a different name for each. And so that's one kind of intelligence that we're very good at. And using that intelligence, then we can manipulate and orchestrate what we know, and using a kind of intuition about how things work, how the thingification of everything, we can make jet airplanes out of it. And that's one kind of intelligence. But there's another kind that's that informs the rest as well. It's not separate at all. I'm just reading a very interesting book called Quiet. If anybody has heard of that book, it's a new book. And it's about I want to say intuition, but it's not. It's about what is the word for quiet people, shy people?
Introverts.
It's about extroversion and introversion. And what she did was to go around the country and interview Harvard Business School, fundamentalist mega church, Silicon Valley, Google and Yahoo and all those people. So she's going around the country and asking them where the place for introverts is. And they all say there is no place for introverts at all. And she talks to the poor people at Harvard who just barely, only a few, who are miserable because they are expected to behave in a way that is not natural to them. So I think there's something about that is what I meant. That there's another kind of knowing that isn't the ta-da kind, that it's much quieter and much deeper. It's a funny answer, but... Yeah, thank you. Sanya?
Yesterday, the young gentleman asked about why do... I can't remember exactly the question about why do we sit or, you know, what are we getting out of this?
Mm-hmm.
And nothing. And I'm thinking, you know, my friends ask me, again, where are you going up to the mountains? What do? You know,
yes.
It would be nice to have, like, a little... them at ease that I'm going to live. And I'm thinking, and you tell me if I'm okay with that, that it's a practice to simply sit but with what comes up.
Yes. Yes.
So is there anything wrong with looking forward to being there?
No, absolutely not. You can say it makes me happy. No, or it makes me...
So does riding a bike or going for a swim.
Well, yes, but somehow you come here, so there must be whatever it... You don't have to say... I mean, you won't say maybe it makes me happy, but you could say whatever it is for you.
But maybe more like your recipe, so you kind of like... You know what I mean?
I do, but I don't...
If you sit, you know... It kind of works.
It kind of works. Yeah.
So there is a reason why we sit.
Well, people want a reason. And so you can say, you know, to be peaceful or to be... And those are all very partial answers, but if you can't describe it to people, it's like trying to describe swimming when you haven't been swimming. It's, but you can be it yourself. That's much more important.
Say that again?
You can be it yourself. That you bring to sitting the way-seeking mind of you, and you leave sitting with the way-seeking mind of you, and that itself is communicating whether you have words for it or not. So just be with your friends and be happy with them, and they'll see what it means.
But they always want to know.
Well, then invite them to come and experience it. Yeah. Or teach them at home. Just give them 5-minute taste of it, and maybe they would understand better. Yes.
very easy to be at peace here. Pranskripa. It's very easy to be at peace here.
Yes.
Because it's quiet, you can meditate. But in the world where most of us live, one has to be active.
Yes.
Exert some amount of extroversion for survival reasons.
Of course.
And could you speak a little bit about the attitude, or whatever you call it, for maintaining that peace, or maintaining what
yes.
you're striving for? in the world which is contrary to this.
Yes.
The activity, extroversion, whatever.
Right.
It's really kind of intruding in.
Yeah.
Think about practicality of maintaining the what we gain here, how there.
That's the most important question. So, because it doesn't amount to a hill of beans unless it has some effect. And yet, if we try to take some fancy thing back to town with us, it's not going to be anything but something fancy that isn't real. So all we can do is continue to be as authentic and true to what we feel as true as we possibly can. And reading this book has given me a clearer idea of what the challenge is. There are some extroverted people, certainly, in our practice, but many, many introverts end up in Zen because it is so quiet and so peaceful. And it can become lopsided. And so we don't need to not get involved in the world, in the speed and the busyness of the world, because we can't avoid it. But we can bring the other side of the side of quiet with us in our own life. Each of us has some kind of space in which we live, and in that space we can create a world of practice, including the cars that we drive and the people that we know. Everything that we do is a way to be. And the way to be is what is most honest. Simply, truly honest and kind. That's all we've got. So we can't change the extroverted world, but we can study it. And we can know more about it. The more we know, the more we know how to create quiet places within it, and to create, to have some kind of effect on it in small ways. It's very interesting, really, that it's come to this. It's fascinating. But for those of us who are going the quiet way, it's a challenge. It's a big challenge. But since we know this, we're experiencing this, then we won't duplicate it back home, but we'll take something with us. We'll be ourselves. We'll be braver, maybe you could say. Have more gumption. Be able to face more difficulty and be more honest about it. So the peace isn't the only thing. The peace is what comes to us so that we can act and act truly and well and strongly and with compassion. Peace all by itself is just peace, and it's a little it's nice, but that's not it. Sometimes they say we need wings to fly with. So that's the action. Okay? Thank you. Yeah.
Why an altar, and particularly a cone? Is it necessary?
Particularly what?
At home.
At home. Well, to my mind, it's an outward evidence of what's inside. And so it's all symbolic. A candle, flowers. Sometimes they have put water, incense. Those things, when they become a practice, bring one back to center and back to the quiet place. So it's iconic and isn't totally necessary, but it's very, very helpful. But we're not bowing to icons. Buddha's inside. Thank you. Yeah.
It was some time ago. I heard a lecture, a podcast lecture about medieval understanding of the human heart, and I was very surprised by their approach. Fundamentally, the heart was not disconnected at all from its external environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that it actually resonated with its surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I remembered more about this, because I was very surprised by the inherent wisdom that they sort of had about it. It wasn't at all about the brain. In terms of the human head, the brain is like immaterial.
Yeah.
As I was reflecting on this moments ago, I was pondering the possibility that the human knowledge at that time was vastly different than it is today. I mean, knowledge was kind of kept in a it was kind of sequestered actually by the elite of the Catholic Church, I presume. I mean, most people couldn't read.
Right.
But that the heart was the central vehicle within the human body. I mean, their knowledge of organs was obviously very different. For example, they believed that the heart pumped blood out the body and then just sort of dissipate. They didn't have an understanding of the circulatory system.
Oh. Hmm.
It was just pumping, producing and pumping.
Uh-huh.
And by the time it reached the extremities, it was done. So it just kept moving it out there. But interestingly enough, I heard, you know, the first heart transplant, what was that man's name that received the mechanical heart?
Bernard. Something. Yes, yes.
He was inconsolably depressed.
Right. Yeah.
And subsequently, I've learned that people who undergo radical heart procedures suffer from terrible depression. So you know, it suggests that there is something that our Google eyes don't get.
Yeah.
I just don't think they get it.
Not yet.
It's perhaps a bit judgmental, but because it's all now, the whole process of medical science is now very much focused on brain activity. In fact, there's a point now where they're not even sure someone's dead.
Oh, I know that, yes.
I mean, that's always been there.
Yes. But now they're figuring it out. Yeah. Well, there are some people who are working on the whole system, Harvard being one place, and Massachusetts General. So it's, and Joan Halifax has a whole coterie of scientists who are working on it, out of Wisconsin, I think. So there's a lot of work going on, more than one can handle, at least I can handle. But it's true. There is something, and everyone knows it. We just don't quite know what it is. But as we sit, we become more and more tender. And as we become more tender, we become much more aware of what's happening here and here. We're not so turned off of our body. We're much more connected to the whole system. Thank you.